Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar Series, where great professors teach you. My name is Richard Davidson, and I'll be your host. Today, we begin a course from the Communication Matters series. That's not what I meant. The Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation. Your professor is Dr. Deborah Tannen, University Professor at Georgetown University. Professor Tannen is an internationally recognized scholar who's received fellowship grants from the Rockefeller Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Science Foundation, the American Council of Learned Societies, and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Professor Tannen is the advisory editor of the series Oxford Studies in Gender and Language, and she's associate editor of the journal Language in Society, as well as serving on the boards of many other journals. Dr. Tannen makes frequent guest appearances on network television, including programs such as 2020, The News Hour with Jim Lehrer, The Today Show, Good Morning America, ABC World News Tonight, and CNN. She's written articles for most major magazines and newspapers, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, USA Today, Time, Newsweek, and the Harvard Business Review. Her book, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation, was on the New York Times bestseller list for nearly 4 years, including 8 months as the number one nonfiction title. Her 18 other books, including the award-winning Talking from 9 to 5, Women and Men at Work, have all garnered critical acclaim. Have you ever had an experience where something you said or didn't say produced a surprising response in the person you were talking to? An innocent remark interpreted as critical, an offhand comment received as an insult. Often the problem is not what we say, but how we say it. We use the term conversational style to refer to the ways we communicate our thoughts and intentions. When conversational styles differ, the conclusions you draw about others and the impressions they get of you may be inaccurate. Conversational styles often vary depending on cultural, regional, and ethnic background, as well as by gender, and even between members of a family. Someone you perceive as aggressive might be trying to make a friendly connection. Someone you perceive as excessively reserved might only want to be polite. In these lectures, we'll learn what conversational style is, how conversational styles can differ, and how these differences affect relationships. We'll learn not only how to recognize these differences, but also how to adapt to them in order to improve relationships at home and at work. In the process, we'll investigate the subfield of linguistics called sociolinguistics, the study of language, and the effects of its use on social interaction. We'll thus come to understand more about the workings of, as well as how to improve, one of the most fundamental aspects of our life. Communication. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin That's Not What I Meant, the Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation, Lecture 1. Conversational Style, the Power of Language in Your Life. And now, Professor Tannen.
I teach a course at Georgetown University called Cross-Cultural Communication. A student who took that course once commented that the course saved her marriage. When I go to scholarly meetings, my fellow linguists stop me in the hall and they tell me that they showed an article that I wrote to a friend or a relative and it saved their marriages. What can linguistics have to do with saving marriages? Linguistics is the academic discipline devoted to understanding how language works. Relationships are made, maintained, and broken through talk. So linguistics provides a concrete way of understanding how relationships are made, maintained, and broken. There are branches of linguistics that are concerned mainly with the history or the grammar or the symbolic representation of language, but there are also branches of the field, and my branch is part of that. You might call it sociolinguistics, discourse analysis, sometimes anthropological linguistics. These branches of linguistics are concerned with understanding how people use language in their everyday lives. The course is called Cross-Cultural Communication because we often approach this from the question, how do people from different cultures use language differently? Looking at these differences helps us understand how language works when it's going well between people of the same culture. These lectures grow out of that branch of linguistics. But the student who said that my course saved her marriage was American and her husband was American. So what would a course in cross-cultural communication have to do with them and their marriage? Well, it has to do with everyone, because all communication is more or less cross-cultural. We learn to use language growing up, and if we grow up in different parts of the country, we have different ethnic background, different regional background, class background, even just being male or female, these all result in different ways of talking. The term that I use to describe these different ways of talking is conversational style. And subtle differences in conversational style can result in differences that may individually be rather minor, but cumulatively over time can really create frustrations. There's a quote that I love from the novelist D.M. Forster in his book, A Passage to India. He says, "A pause in the wrong place, an intonation misunderstood, and a whole conversation went awry." When conversations go awry, we look for causes, and we usually find them by blaming ourselves or the other person or the relationship. What I'll try to show in these lectures is how much of that blame may be misplaced. Often, bad feelings are just the result of misunderstandings that arise because people who are speaking to each other have different conversational styles. I was once introduced by a talk show host saying that in his long career, he'd read a lot of books about speaking, but they were all about public speaking. But most of the talk that we do during our lives isn't public, it's private speaking, talk between two or just a few people. These lectures are about private speaking, how it works, why it goes well sometimes and badly at others. The lectures will explain the invisible processes of conversational style and how they shape relationships. Understanding these processes can restore a sense of control over our lives because it makes it possible to improve communication and relationships in all the settings in which people talk to each other. At work, in interviews, in public affairs, but most important of all, to the people we're closest to, at home. A perfectly tuned conversation is a vision of sanity. You start to speak at just the right time. You make a joke and the other person laughs. Everything just seems to be going right. It assures you you're a right sort of person. You feel like God's in his heaven and all's right with the world. Nothing is more deeply disquieting than a conversation gone awry. You say something that you think is funny and the other person looks like you punched them in the stomach. You try to find a way into the conversation and you just can't get the beat, like trying to join a line of dancers and you just can't pick up the beat. If the conversation is a fleeting one, the consequences may be minor, though the cumulative effect could be dire. But if the conversation is at work, it can get in the way of your job satisfaction and even your advancement. It's most frustrating and painful when these differences occur in a really close relationship. The person who should understand you, if anyone does, doesn't seem to understand how you mean what you say. When we speak to each other, we tend to think of the meaning that we want to convey or the meaning that the other person is conveying. But the way an individual says what he or she means also carries meaning. And that's where the analysis that we can do in linguistics comes in. The way we say what we mean is what I call conversational style. What is conversational style? It's everything about how you say what you mean. We learn it growing up, and it varies by all the elements that we might call culture. So, of course, the country that you grow up in and the language that you speak, that affects how you say what you mean. But also ethnic background, class, age, gender, but many other influences too. Sexual orientation, profession, a psychologist, someone in the military, a lawyer, an accountant, all develop different ways of saying what we mean. The really tricky thing is that conversational style is invisible. We draw conclusions in terms of abilities and intentions, or if we associate a speaker with a certain cultural group, then we associate their way of speaking with stereotypes about that group. People often ask me, wouldn't we all be better off if we just said what we meant? Well, yes, but we can only say what we mean in our own conversational style. Let me get more specific here. Some of the aspects of conversational style that are decisions you have to make about how to say what you mean would be the following. Amplitude, in other words, how loudly or softly do you speak? Pacing and pausing, how quickly or slowly do you speak, both within your own turn, but also with respect to the other person? In other words, when do you get the sense your turn is over and it's my turn to speak? How much of a pause do you expect before you think, okay, you have nothing to say and it's my turn to speak? In other words, turn-taking. Intonation. As we speak, we have shifts in pitch, and everything we say has a kind of rhythm or music to it, that musical level of speech. Directness and indirectness. So are you going to come out and say what you mean in so many words, or are you going to hint at it? We all tell stories when we speak, but what can those stories be about? How do you get to the point? Joking, teasing, sarcasm, all of those ways of saying one thing but meaning it somewhat differently, those are all aspects of conversational style too. It's not just speaking, but also listening. How do you show that you're listening? Do you say, yeah? How often do you say it? Would you show you're listening with very long phrases? Oh, yeah, I know just what you mean. Or even telling a story similar to the other story to show that you're listening? There are also a whole range of nonverbal correlates, and we call this kinesics. That would be the study of how people move when they talk to each other. Let me get a little bit more specific about what I mean by elements of conversational style. Everything about how you say what you mean. Let's start with the most simple level, what linguists call amplitude. In other words, loudness. How loudly or softly do you speak? When you talk to someone whose normal level of loudness is different from yours, you make interpretations. So you might think a person is angry. And this is an experience that people often have when they move to the Mediterranean or visit the Mediterranean, Italy, Greece, for example. They think that people are shouting when they're just talking at a normal level. Another difference would be pacing and pausing. So how quickly or slowly do you speak? This is something that I'll have quite a bit to say about in a later lecture, but let me give you an idea right here. Whenever two people speak, each person has to make some decision about when the other person's turn is over and it's their turn to begin. One way they make that decision is pausing. How long a pause do you expect before you get the idea, okay, you're done, and now it's my turn? We know that this can differ very much based on conversational style. So there are some people who, when they begin speaking, really don't pause at all. What they might do is kind of start recycling what they're saying to let you know, okay, you can speak here, because they feel that a perceptible pause would be a bad thing. It would indicate, gee, there's something wrong with this conversation. It's winding down. Now, there are other people, and American Indian culture has been suggested here, where a rather long pause is needed before you get the feeling, okay, the other person is really done, and it's your turn to begin. What happens when two people speak and they have a different sense of pacing and pausing is that the one who was waiting for the longer pause often never gets it because the one who is expecting the shorter pause begins to speak. They think, uh-oh, the other person has nothing to say. I'd better begin. So these small differences in pacing and pausing can cause a lot of frustration in a conversation. There's also the question of how quickly or slowly you speak. A combination of amplitude, pacing, and pausing, the elements I've just been talking about, all play a role in turn-taking. So we have to have these very subtle ways of deciding when your turn is over and it's my turn to begin. Getting somewhat louder would be one way of showing you want to take the floor or you don't want to give up the floor because you're not finished. Speeding up would be another way to say, don't interrupt me here, I'm not finished, or wait a minute, I have something to add. When turn-taking habits are shared, that's one of the things that gives conversation that wonderfully smooth flow that I was talking about, where you feel everything's right, I'm a right sort of person, you're a right sort of person, and we're really getting along. When turn-taking habits are not shared, it's one of the things that can really make you feel, I don't know what's going wrong here. Nothing seems to be clicking. And you draw conclusions about the other person's intentions toward you. And this is one of the really important points about conversational style that we'll be getting back to throughout these lectures. We don't tend to think in terms of ways of speaking. We tend to think in terms of personality, what kind of person you are, or intentions, what your intentions are toward me. So if you think you're just taking your turn because it was really time and the other person wasn't ready to give up their turn, they might draw the conclusion that you're not interested in them or you're an aggressive, self-interested, self-absorbed sort of person. You only want to hear yourself talk. At the same time, the person who's waiting for the other person to talk but the other person never seems to take their turn might be thinking, you don't have much to say, maybe you're not that bright, and maybe you don't like me. So that's the pattern that we'll see. The conclusions that we tend to draw are not about conversational style, but about the person. Another aspect of conversational style is the musical level of speech, intonation patterns, shifts in pitch. Of course, this goes along with amplitude or loudness as well. A linguist who has done a lot of work in this area, who I'll be referring to, is John Gumpers. He gives an example where an intonational pattern might signal, this is an expression that has a kind of formulaic meaning, but a person who doesn't understand that, recognize that formulaic meaning, might misunderstand it. So this is the example that he gives. A British woman marries an American, moves to the United States, and someone comes in the house to do some kind of work, and he looks around the room and he says, "Who's the artist?" And the way he says it kind of implies, I'm assuming one of the people in this family painted these pictures. And which one of you is it? But she doesn't understand that that intonation pattern signals that kind of formula, you might say. And so she starts explaining who the paintings were painted by and what kind of artist he was and when he lived. So she missed that intonation pattern. And in the examples that I'll be giving later in some of my later lectures, you'll see how using an intonation pattern that isn't familiar to you not only sometimes leads to misunderstanding, but can actually seem rude. A very significant aspect of conversational style is relative directness and indirectness. Americans in particular often assume that directness is good and indirectness is a little bit underhanded. But in fact, it's impossible to say exactly what we mean in so many words. If in every sentence that you spoke, you took time to back up and put into words all the assumptions underlying what you said, you would probably have a full paragraph of assumptions for every sentence that you spoke. Let me give you some examples of directness and indirectness. Supposing somebody invites you to go to dinner and you don't really want to go to dinner with that person, are you going to say, nope, don't want to go to dinner with you? Or are you going to say, oh, gee, thanks so much, I'm really busy. Maybe some other time. For many of the aspects of conversational style that I'll be discussing, I'll give examples that have come from students that have taken my classes. And many of these examples are of directness and indirectness in communication among roommates. So, for example, let's say three women or three men are sharing an apartment and one roommate isn't washing his or her dishes. Are you going to say to that other person, hey, wash your dishes? Or are you going to say something indirect like, are those your dishes in the sink? When we talk to each other, we often tell stories, tell about our experiences. I don't mean stories in the sense of a short story, but tell about experiences, tell something that happened during the day. It may seem pretty straightforward, but there are so many different ways that you can tell a story. So, what would a story be about? In one study that I did, there were some speakers who told stories about very personal experiences and what their feelings were about those experiences, whereas other people told more impersonal stories about events, and they didn't really tell how they felt about it. each of those people reacted to the other people's stories in a way that showed they weren't quite satisfied with the way the story had been told. So, for example, one man told a story and then something that happened, and then at the end he said, and I thought, oh, that explains so many things. And he stopped. The person who was listening to the story, his friend, said, yeah, well, he didn't expect the point of the story just to be dramatized in that way. Ah, that explains so many things. At the same time, that person who told his story in that way seemed to always expect stories to have a kind of personal point, you know, how you felt about it. So if his friend told a story about, well, you know, this happened and that happened, and then didn't go on to say how he felt about it, his friend would say, yeah, and how did you feel about it? How did that make you feel? It sounds almost like a therapist, but it was more just the story didn't seem to end in the way you expected it to. In addition to telling stories, that is, telling about our experiences, we're often playing with language in a whole range of ways. So we joke, we tease, we're sarcastic. And here, too, there are a whole range of conversational style decisions that you make. What can the jokes be about? How do you get to the point of the joke? Are you someone who thinks teasing is a way of showing affection to someone that you're close to? Or are you really offended by teasing? And there can be cultural differences to this as to many other things that I will be talking about. So, for example, a sociologist named Sandra Petronio is an Italian-American, and she has written about how in her family, one way of showing affection to people that you really liked was teasing. In other words, you playfully insult them. You bring up things that are really a little bit sensitive and call attention to them. And it's all in pretty good humor. She found when she moved out of the Italian-American context to the Midwest, where she teaches, she was constantly having to apologize because people's feelings were hurt. And she would say, no, I'm just teasing. All of the things I've been talking about so far, these aspects of conversational style, are focusing on the speaker. But how about the listener? How do you show that you're listening? And this one is really funny because I'm so often asked, well, wouldn't all our problems be solved if we just were better listeners? To an extent, that's true, but just listening is only the first step. How are you going to let the other person know that you're listening? Are you the sort of person who listens quietly? Show your attention by not making any verbal noise? Or are you the sort of person who shows you're listening by making a lot of listener noise? Mm-hmm, uh-huh, yeah, I know just what you mean. Right, oh boy, wow. Or even telling a whole story to show that you got the point of the other person's story. So there's a whole range of ways of showing that you're listening. If you talk to someone who is giving you more of this listener noise than you expect, you might think they're rushing you along. In other words, they're not interested. If you talk to someone who gives you less listener noise than you expect, then you might conclude, again, they're really not interested. And as with so many of the things I'm talking about, there are cross-cultural differences. A Japanese woman that I know commented she was very fluent in English, and in fact, she had no accent speaking Japanese or speaking English, but she commented that her friends would know from a distance whether she was speaking English or Japanese because when she was speaking Japanese, her head would be bobbing up and down much more often. That's because she was doing something that the Japanese call aizuchi. It's listener noise. Hi, hi, hi. And of course, you can't see me because you're listening on audio, but my head is going up and down, nodding while I say that. Hi, hi. So that's a way that Japanese listeners show that they're listening. And it may come across if they do the same thing when talking to Americans as perhaps rushing us along. I described the head nods going along with the aizuchi, and that's one of a whole range of ways that we have nonverbal correlates to conversational style. The word that describes the science of the studying of body movement is kinesics, and that's spelled K-I-N-E-S-I-C-S, kinesics. So how physically distant or close are you going to stand to the person you're talking to? This one can be very funny. If two people speak and one is expecting to stand a bit closer than the other, they end up doing a dance by which they might move all the way down the hall because the person who is a little uncomfortable because they think they should stand closer moves closer. That makes the other person uncomfortable because they feel they need a little more physical distance, so they move away. Well, then the first person moves closer, the second person moves away, and before you know it, they may have moved all the way down the hall. In fact, and I'll be referring to my own style at various times throughout these lectures, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and my sense of physical distance is a fairly close one. I was once talking to a colleague in an open area at Georgetown University, and I almost pushed him over a precipice as he kept backing up and I kept getting closer. Do you reach out and touch the other person when you talk to them? What's your body orientation like? Do you expect to face them head on, or do you kind of sit at angles or stand at angles and face your body outward? Eye gaze can be very, very delicate and a very significant part of conversational style. So when you're listening, do you stare directly at the person who's speaking to you, or do you kind of look a little bit off and just glance to check on them from time to time? Laughter is a significant element of conversational style. We know that there are cultures, for example, many Asian cultures, Indonesian culture, where laughter is a kind of automatic way of dealing with uncomfortable topics. Most Westerners tend to laugh only because they found something specific funny, and that can cause misunderstandings in conversation, too. So these are some of the elements of conversational style that we'll be looking at throughout these lectures. To recap some of the principles about conversational style, first of all, we don't focus on style, we focus on what we want to say. It's not that conversational style is unconscious, but it is automatic and it's invisible. We look through it at the meaning. I don't say it's unconscious because if I were to call your attention to it, you would know that you were talking in that way. Based on their way of speaking, we draw conclusions about personality, intentions, and abilities. When we mean well and someone reacts negatively, we tend to blame them or maybe ourselves, or if we're a generous sort of person, the relationship. Knowing that the culprit may be conversational style differences lifts that burden of pathology and blame. Becoming aware of conversational style differences provides a first line of defense. If you're not getting the result that you want in a conversation with a person, usually our impulse is to do more of the same, to try harder. If you're aware of conversational style, you might do something different. So, for example, if you're doing all the talking and the other person doesn't seem to be saying anything, often your impulse will be to talk more because you're uncomfortable. If you think about conversational style, you might just back off, count to seven, and find amazing they actually begin to speak. If you're the one who never gets a chance to talk, your impulse might be to get more and more annoyed at the other person until you're not going to talk at all because you think this person just doesn't want to hear what you have to say anyway. You might try pushing yourself to begin speaking more quickly, and you might find that amazingly they stop talking and they really do listen. Perhaps the most important aspect, though, is the lifting of blame. And people are much more likely to change if they think in terms of style rather than the kind of person they are. So if someone tells you they want you to give them more chance to talk because they're being bullheaded and self-centered, they're not going to want to change because that would mean admitting that they're bullheaded and self-centered. But if you talk about it on the level of style, people are much more likely to want to adapt. At the end of the movie Annie Hall, there's a quote that I really love. You hear Woody Allen's voiceover saying, "This guy goes to a psychiatrist and says, 'Doc, my brother's crazy. He thinks he's a chicken.' And the doctor says, 'Well, why don't you turn him in?' And the guy says, 'I would, but I need the eggs.' Well, that's pretty much how I feel about relationships." The reason I love that quote is that it captures how many of us keep having conversations with people even though they don't go as well as we would wish. The conversational chicken doesn't give us the perfect communication eggs that we seek, but we keep at it because we need relationships with others, not just romantic relationships, but all the fleeting and ongoing interactions that make up our lives. These lectures will show how linguistics can begin to shed light on how conversation works. What's going on when it goes well? What can be the cause when it goes awry? And how you can make changes to increase the chances that more of your conversations will go well. And as a result, you'll be more likely to have successful relationships, both at work and, perhaps most important, at home.
After listening to Lecture 1, a student posed this question to Professor Tannen. Are there cultural differences in how people have responded to the introduction of cell phones? Let's listen to the professor's response.
I'm very intrigued by the cultural differences in how people respond to cell phones. Among Americans, it's almost self-evident. It's just taken as obvious that it's intrusive for a person to talk on a cell phone when they're in conversational space with someone actually in front of them. So, for example, there may be signs, "This is a cell-free zone." When you go into the theater or some kind of lecture or performance, someone will often start by saying, "Please turn off your cell phones and pagers." And it's not unusual for the audience to erupt in applause. In fact, one of the movie theater chains has a little promo where they show that if you use your cell phone, you'll be ejected from your seat. It's the kind of height of hostility. These ethics are really very different in other cultures. I spent some time in Greece, and I was really struck that there people totally accept that cell phone calls are going to be made, and they themselves make cell phone calls, and they value that connection between people who may not be there over the sanctity, you might say, of quiet between the person in front of you and you. So, for example, I actually gave a lecture in Greece to it was actually a meeting of head and neck surgeons from around the world, and I gave this lecture in Greece. And people's cell phones rang during my lecture, and nobody seemed to be offended. And when you think about it, it didn't bother me any. It was a big hall, and they were way in the back, and it really wasn't a problem. I had been picked up at the airport by the Greek physician who was running that meeting, and his cell phone kept ringing in the car, which surprised me because Americans, again, are so negative about driving and talking on the cell phone. So I said, "Gee, that must be about the conference that you're running." And he said, "No, it's patients calling me." "Really?" I said. He said, "Oh, yes. You know, if someone's just had surgery and they're in the hospital, they need to be able to call their doctor anytime." And I said, "Oh, my goodness, doesn't it, don't you find they abuse it?" He said, not much. He said, "Occasionally you'll get someone who calls too much, but no, you know, if a person is worried about something, I want them to be able to call me so I can reassure them." And I thought, wow, you know, there's something to this. This idea that you can't ever reach your doctor because his personal space is so private. There's something to be said for that. A similar difference in value. I talked to someone who was visiting Israel, and she walked into a store, and the person behind the counter was talking on the cell phone and didn't get off right away. Boy, was she put off by that. "I'm here in front of you. You should be talking to me, not on the cell phone." But she realized after living there for a while that that was the ethics there, that people were in constant touch with people they were close to, people they loved. And you can imagine now with the situation in Israel why that might be of special importance. And everybody respected that and valued that. And so you walk into a store and you don't mind that the guy is behind the counter might make you wait a couple minutes, but it also means that you too can be in touch with the people you love and the people you need to talk to.
This ends Lecture 1.